and start with the recording and start with the general preamble that we have. This is Tom Borges of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today is October 21st. The time is approximately 4:45. I am accompanied by different members of our group, both in the commission. So I'd like the FCIC people just to state their name and spell their name for the record.
This is Joby Danganan, J-O-B-E, Danganan, D-A-N-G-A-N-A-N.
Is it Mike Easterly, E-A-S-T-E-R-L-Y?
This is Jennifer Collins, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R-C-O-L-L-I-N-S.
And this is Tom Borges, B-O-R-G-E-R-S. And Mr. Karp, I just wanted to ask you, could you state your name and spell your name for the record?
It's Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, Karp, K-A-R-P.
And Mr. Karp, would you give us your verbal assent to this recording?
Yeah.
In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the president. It is a bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and the collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the president and Congress by 15 of December 2010. One note that I have to say to all of our people that we interview that we are an agency of the U.S. government and just be concerned about any false statements. So without anything else, I'd like to start with the questioning, Mike, that hold on a second.
It must be Jessica.
Is that Jessica?
Yeah.
Okay. Jessica, can you please state your name? And we're recording this for the record. State and spell your name.
It's Jessica Lee, L-E-E.
Thank you very much. Jessica, we've just asked Mr. Karp whether or not he agrees to this interview. Would you agree to recording of this interview also?
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your patience with this formality. I'd like to start with the questions from one of our analysts here, Mike Easterly. He's going to dedicate some the first part of our interview with you, Mike, to cover the issues that he's concerned about. He has another interview to go at after this, so if you don't mind, I want to hand it over to Mike right now.
Okay. I have a fairly simple question. I was looking at the reports that you shared with us for 2005 and 2006 and I think 07 and 08, and I'm wondering if you have similar data for previous years, how far back it would go and whether you'd be willing to share it with us.
We don't have similar data prior to 2005. We started compiling this in 2005, and since then we've kept records of all the reports. So whatever reports we had, we sent them to you.
Okay. So
I have been in business since 1993.
Yeah.
So I do know, you know, a lot, but we did not compile these reports prior to 2005.
Okay. That's fine. I think that's all the questions that I have.
Just for Mike Easterly, Mike, would you want to ask him some questions about the market back in during those times that he doesn't have a report on but might be able to give you some?
Right. Well, I mean, I have to go, but if in talking to Tom, Joby, and Jennifer, there are changes in what you're talking about over time since you started in this business, I would be interested in you indicating that.
I mean, since I started in the business, securitized products was a very sought-out product, and all different institutions were looking to grow in it. When I started, there weren't just 9 or 10 big institutions. There were close to 70 big institutions that were looking to get into this business. And over the years, momentum has built, and, you know, a lot of the guys got into this business. And if you remember back in the 90s, Kidder Peabody was big in this business, Payne Weber was big in this business, DLJ was big in this business, and all these three banks were taken over as well. So, you know, over the years, we've seen a lot of consolidation, but, you know, it is a business that a lot of, you know, it is profitable for a lot of financial institutions, hence we see, you know, still the top 8-9 big, you know, banks in this business.
Right. And were there any changes in compensation practices? I think my colleagues will have more specific questions, but can you see anything different from back then?
Look, until LTCM in 1998, this was one of the most sought-out product. And in my opinion, compensation was as high as 2007, which was a big year in compensation for this product. So, you know, and once LTCM blew up, when that 98 mortgage crisis happened, a lot of the banks pulled out of this business, and that's when the consolidation in the business started. And that's when, you know, DLJ was bought by Credit Suisse. That's when, you know, Payne Weber and Kidder Peabody merged, and Morgan Stanley took over Payne Weber. So, you know, and then, you know, UBS was trying to get into the business as well. So, you know, and then when after September 11th, the momentum in the business, you know, began again. And when the big credit cycle started, that's when all these institutions started getting back into the business. So in my opinion, on the compensation front, you know, it was still a frenzy, and people were still getting paid, you know, serious amounts of money in this product.
Okay, and in terms of the form of the structure of compensation, and I'm thinking about salary, bonuses, how much is in equity, how much is in restricted stock, how much is in options, you know, all those sort of things. Did that change over time?
Yes, it has changed over time. Salaries in the early to late 90s were, you know, base salaries were up to $200,000 for managing directors, you know, and the base salaries in the current market since 2008 have started, 2009 I would say, have started going up.
Okay.
And the stock compensation, you know, some of these individuals used to get compensated way more in cash, and I have seen that the equity awards have sort of gone way up over the years.
All right. Was that a steady increase, or were there breakpoints, you know, like you mentioned, 98 and 2001?
2000 and 98 and 2001.
There may be any date that was there, but I'm just wondering if this is a continuous increase, or if there are some important points where something significant changed.
Look, I mean, the base salaries never change, so the base salaries have been a steady increase year on year, and you know the bonuses change. So 98 was a zero bonus year for mortgage, you know, securitized products, you know, across
right.
the board. And 2001 was a pretty you know, a pretty bad year as well. But then over the years, the bonuses have just steadily increased as the P&Ls have increased. And as the credit cycle increased, you know, the bonuses increased as well.
Well, I think, Mike, and I don't know if I've got this correct, but also maybe, you know, 2008 was a big turning point as far as banks not having enough cash.
Yes.
Because it gave a bigger portion of the bonus in equity.
Yes, and 2008 was a pretty, you know, pretty bad year as well in compensation for the securitized products area.
All right. But in terms of what the traders or the bankers were told, that what their compensation would be based on, you know, at the beginning of the year rather than when they received their bonus, did that change?
I mean, I don't know how you're phrasing this question, but now the bankers know at the beginning of the year what their bonus is going to look like. They find out their bonus at the end of the year. So, you know, at the end of the year, they were told that, you know, there is no bonus in some cases because banks lost a ton of money.
Right. Okay. I think I understand. You also, this is not a compensation-related question, but you mentioned 1998 and 2001 as significant points in the business. 2004, the Fed increased interest rates significantly, and that was disruptive to many markets. Did that also affect the sort of markets that you look at?
Yes, absolutely. 2004 was a significant year as well. So if you look at the rates businesses and if you look at the FX businesses, they were pretty affected in 2004 as well when the Fed started tightening. And when the Fed started tightening, you know, a lot of the P&Ls for a lot of the banks dropped. So you know, that is a significant year as well, actually.
All right. Thank you very much. I think that's all that I have.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Mike, you know, I'm going to hand it over to Jennifer and Joby. You know, I'm going to I'll be here and probably throwing some comments and questions to you also, but they're spearheading a good portion of this review. And you know, I'm giving him my input because I'm also grew up on Wall Street and was involved in the executive search too, and am a banker and an analyst. So, but I'm going to hand it over to Jennifer and Joby right now.
Sure.
Mike, thanks again so much for your time. I was just wondering, we've read your report, but can you just explain what Options Group is and the type of work that you do?
Options Group is an executive search firm and a consulting firm. Mm-hmm. We have been in business since 1993. We have, at the current time, over 125 people worldwide, out of which 100 people are consultants, executive search, and research analysts. We cover major financial institutions, hedge funds, asset managers, family offices, to do executive search placements, finding people for them, and doing strategic consulting work in terms of compensation analysis and gap analysis of various different businesses before any company gets into a new business that they're looking to get into.
And you've alluded to this earlier, but can you just go through briefly your educational and work background?
I went to university at New York Institute of Technology. I did not finish college there. I started business in 1991. In November of 92, one of my partners and myself, we incorporated Options Group and we started working in terms of the placement business. We started off placing high-level quants and technology folks, and then over the years the business has grown into incorporating investment banking, global markets, and alternative investment managers and portfolio managers.
Okay. And as Tom might have mentioned, the FCIC was created by Congress last year, and we're tasked with examining the cause or causes of the financial collapse. And according to the statute, two of the issues relate to compensation. We're examining whether incentive compensation contributed to the financial crisis. And one of the things we're looking at is seeing how every player in the scheme, a mortgage, the subprime scheme, were compensated, starting from the mortgage brokers to the lenders to the bankers who securitized the RMBS and the CDOs, all the way up to the senior executives, even the rating agencies. Do you have any thoughts initially as to whether you think compensation incentives contributed to the crisis?
Look, I do not know, you know, a lot about mortgage brokers because we do not place mortgage brokers. We have nothing to do with mortgage brokers. Mm-hmm. But we do work in the securitized products area where we do sort of find originators for mortgages as bankers, as Tom probably knows this, and we do find traders and salespeople. And in my true opinion, I don't think, you know, people were driven by greed or by, you know, people were driven by compensation to sort of get into this crisis.
Okay. Could you just explain generally how bankers are compensated at the institutions you've studied?
So the institutions that we've studied and the institutions that we work with, what we've seen is that most bankers, you know, have a base salary. A base salary is the cash compensation that they get paid bimonthly, mm-hmm. and you know they get a bonus at the end of the year. And bonuses, you know, are determined by senior management and board boards. So it's very tough for anyone to know what their bonus is going to look like until the end of the year. At the end of the year, none of these banks have percentage deals in terms of paying their sell side traders and their bankers. So none of these guys know exactly what percentage of P&L they would see. So everyone has to wait till January, February of the following year to see what the bonus pools look like. And the boards and I think the CEOs and the executive committees determine what the bonus pools look like. And it's very hard for me to comment on what the bonus pools look like because we are not involved in terms of, you know, helping these institutions develop their bonus pools.
Mm-hmm. But, if I might interject here, Mike, is that you are involved in the range of bonus compensation on Wall Street, though, right?
We the way we do it is we speculate. You know, as our 80 plus consultants worldwide talk to, you know, at least 10 candidates a day. So we find out what their compensation looks like, you know, from the previous year, and then we aggregate. And then as the quarterly results come out of every institution, we try to backtrack and reverse engineer P&Ls and see if, you know, what areas are making money to see how much they will make or not. So most of our determinations that come out are on public knowledge on a quarterly basis when the results come out. So our numbers are mostly guesstimations of what those guys, what those seats would make, you know, and over year on year, you will see an increase of anywhere from, you know, increase or decrease anywhere from, you know, up to 30% or down 30%. We never see, you know, comps that are sort of doubled or tripled, you know, every year. I mean, if you understand what I'm trying to say here, you know. Mm-hmm. So you won't see a person that makes $1 million, you know, jump up suddenly to $5 million.
All right. So for our case study, we're specifically interested in folks who securitize RMBS and the CDOs. On your study, which divisions would they fall in?
In the securitized products division.
And are these further subdivided, or?
They're not subdivided. They are bunched all together because mm-hmm. all those desks sort of, you know, work in tandem. So, you know, for example, in the last year or 2 years, the CDO business has not been active. So, yeah. You know, most of those guys are sitting on the mortgage desks or in the ABS area, which is asset-backed securities.
Mm-hmm. And is there an incentive there to generate as much volume as possible so that at the end of the year, the specific division would get a larger proportion of the bonus?
I have never had sort of any conversations with people that work on those desks where, you know, it's sort of incentivized to create more volumes. I think the business is very competitive, mm-hmm. so people sort of, you know, try to, you know, it's like a sports event. They like to win the World Series. But, you know, I have never probably seen a person walk into my office and say, hey, if I create the volume, I'll get paid more. I've never had those kind of conversations.
But Mike, wouldn't there be an understanding of goal setting that they expected, you know, the top players
to... Absolutely, yeah, yes. There are budgets at the beginning of the year, and the budgets are determined by the head of the desks. And the way they base the budgets are sort of depending on, you know, the last year or 2 years and what the market outlook for the following year would be.
Mm-hmm. So what's your understanding as to how these underwriters of RMBS and CDOs were compensated?
I mean, look, you know, they were compensated competitively across the board, and they were compensated probably, you know, quite on the same lines as any other business unit would be compensated. But, you know, if the desks did generate major profits, then those guys were compensated, you know, a little bit better than some of the other colleagues in some other divisions would have.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you familiar, for example, in 2006 at Merrill Lynch, folks who underwrote RMBS and CDOs specifically folks in fixed income disproportionately got a larger pool of the bonus than other areas. And I think the New York Times reported that Dow Kim made almost as much as the CEO. I think he was the head of fixed income. Is that your understanding as to how compensation worked?
Look, I mean, I haven't read the New York Times article, so, you know, I don't think that's how the compensation works. And, you know, I think senior managers at these institutions, you know, if you get away from even just Merrill Lynch, get, you know, competitive compensation to the CEO of the bank. So if that's what you know, New York Times reported, you know, I would love to. I'm going to read that article and I'll see where it was. But I can't comment on what, you know, CEO's comp was and what Dow Kim's comp was. You know.
Okay. What's your understanding as to how bonuses are distributed at the end of the year at the institutions you've studied?
Every institution is sort of at the end of the year marks a bonus pool. So there is a you know, comp to revenue ratio, and then the different, you know, then I would say the executive committees of various different firms dole out the bonuses. So, you know, I'll just give you a hypothetical example. So if there's a $10 billion bonus pool, you know, the CEO would say $1 billion goes to private wealth management, $1 billion goes to asset management, you know, $2 billion goes to investment banking, and $6 billion goes to securities. Out of $6 billion, $4 would go to fixed income, $2 would go to equities, or vice versa. And then those senior managers sort of sit with their teams and determine what the bonus pool for different desks would look like.
And traditionally, at these historic investment banks, is it the case that 50% of the net revenue goes out in bonuses? Is that correct? Is that your understanding? Roughly 50%.
In the high years, we've seen 45% to 50%. But, you know, normally we've seen anywhere from between 30% and 35%, 36%. If you look at the Wall Street Journal report that came out, I think last year and the year before, 08 was lower. I think last year was 32.2% at an average. The year before that was 37%. And I think 07 was like 36 or 37%. Mm-hmm. There was a report in the journal. If you look at it, you'll be able to get those numbers.
Okay. And is it Have you ever seen a case where an investment bank or a similarly situated bank had to subsequently write down their net revenues, and was there ever a clawback?
I haven't seen clawbacks until 08, but I'm seeing clawbacks now.
Okay. And why do you think that is?
I guess they learned a lesson, you know, after they lost a lot of money and five of the major banks went under.
Now, before 08, in terms of just looking at the crisis, do you think the fact that there was no clawback, and what was it, did underwriters sort of just generate volume without regard to quality? Was that your sense? Or I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I do not do the underwriting business, so I do not do the brokerage business and underwriting business. So it's a little bit tough for me to comment. So, you know, Tom, you've been in the on the other side. So, you know, we do mostly work. You know, we mostly place traders, salespeople, and investment banking, mortgage origination. So, you know, and asset back. So it's hard for me to comment on the brokers and the underwriters if they had an incentive to sort of, you know, underwrite more to get paid more. You know.
Well, I guess they all had individual goals, so they each member of the team of a structured finance group had to meet those their specific goals and then their team goals. Wouldn't you agree, Mike?
Yes, I agree on that. So they have a budget and they have the team goals that they have to hit. So, you know, so that's how that business works. And then they go to the banks and stuff, and then they sell their stuff to the banks. So we do more of the sell side stuff than the origination stuff.
And maybe you might want to take a second to present your take on the budget. We're talking about the budget, and I think my colleagues here would want to hear about that budget process. Or what your knowledge about it is.
So my knowledge about a budget is that at the beginning of the, around November, October, November time frame, the desk head, you know, presents what the business has done over the first three quarters and what the outlook of the fourth quarter would be. And then they set up goals and they set up, you know, specific targets in terms of P&Ls that they need to generate. So, you know, so if, for example, it's getting away from, you know, mortgages, if you walk into a rates, you know, if you walk into a guy who runs the rates business will sit with the executive committee of the firm. He'll tell them that the last three, you know, quarters, his desk made $1 billion, and, you know, the budget for the year was 1.3. So either he's on budget or he's off, you know, or he's slightly off budget. So if he's on budget, he knows, you know, how his bonus pools are going to look like, because, you know, he knows from traditionally from years whether they were 2% or 3% of the $1 billion that he has to dole out between 8-10 people, you know, so he will look at that, and then, you know, he'll determine what the next year looks like, you know, and puts a solid budget in. So, you know, this is the same way securitized products work, and, you know, by December, every single desk knows what their budget is going to look like. And then they keep a track of it over the year, over the quarters, if you're on budget or under budget. And if you are under budget, obviously your bonus pool will be lower, and if you're over budget, your bonus pool will be higher.
Now, have you heard from your universe of people that the executive committee and the higher ups in the company will, if they present a budget of X, that they the higher ups may say increase your budget levels to meet a certain range?
Yes, that happens as well. You know, sometimes where the management will come and say your budget levels are low, increase them. You know.
Okay. Getting back to the traders and the bankers. Specifically looking at the short-term job security, can you give some color as to the turnover rate amongst bankers?
Oh, can you please repeat that?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at, if you could give some color as to the turnover rate of different bankers, of bankers in Wall Street, given that we just want to see whether they're incentivized to make as much as possible in a short period of time, given the possibility of layoffs or...
I can't comment on that because I haven't worked in sight. So, you know, I mean, it's hard for me to say if a bank would... I mean, I don't think it's ethical. I don't think that's how banks sort of, you know, portray that if you get more revenue, we'll pay you more. I don't think that's the mantra of the banks, to be honest with you.
Well, Mike, could you comment on what was the average length of stay for the typical structured finance trader, whatever? Do you have any color on that?
It varies from firm to firm. So, you know, at an average, I would say we have seen, you know, one professional being at one firm for 7 years.
So they would really like to hold on to their...
They really like to hold on to their people. And, you know, what I've seen is it's a seven-year itch. So, you know, a trader or a salesperson or a banker, you know, would stay for seven. And there have been some teams in the business that have been together for over 15 years.
Would you also comment on... I know executive search firms, that's how you make your money, but also you make your money on giving detailed analyses of for your clients also. How often did it happen during this time period when one Wall Street firm would try to get some of their major deal makers to another and the deal maker, a present firm, might just come back and give him such a great offer to stay. How often did that happen?
85% of the time.
How often?
85% of the time it happened.
Which is, I find interesting, is that in most other segments of the market, it's there's no counter offers.
Yeah, on the corporate side, there are no counter offers. I mean, look, this is, you know, I compare myself to a sports agent. This is like, you know, playing for the Yankees and then, you know, being recruited for the Texas Rangers. You know what I'm saying, right? So, I mean, it's very competitive. So, and to be honest with you, I've probably lost more deals in my life to counter offers, you know, in that business than to any other. And if I closed every deal, you know, I would be very wealthy, if you understand what I'm trying to say.
So it's fair to
different product area as well, right? It's not product specific to securitized products.
It's across the board.
Yeah.
I've lost major deals over the years. Over the last 5 years, I've lost major deals where, you know, and look, as a headhunter, Tom, you know this because you know the business. We don't get compensated till we deliver. You know what I'm saying, right? So, I mean, you know, so it's always, you know, and there's some times where you work with a candidate for 3 months and then he gets counter offer and then you never hear back from him for your lifetime, you know?
But it is for products.
It's all products.
All products.
It's
not
across the board.
To, you know, securitize products. It's
across the board, and, yeah. You know, until 2008, it was, you know, a lot for securitized products because it was very tough to find, you know, superstar, you know, mortgage traders. It's very, very tough, you know.
Do you think that maybe the idea that, you know, they were compensated better, it more reflects the fact that these people have a very, you know, that they have the brain power and they have a special skill set, you know, which any place you are actually paid a premium for.
I agree, 100%. It's like being the best cardiologist in the world.
Yeah, it's more about the skill set and the brain power and the fact that there's not a lot of you out there that you get paid more, and that happens in any industry, you know, not exclusively with, you know, securitized products.
And I think just to comment on the street way back when, this has been, they would hold on to the talent even in the 70s and 80s. And I know, Mike, you commented on the 90s and 2000, but even with, we've interviewed some of the older stars, they were even commenting on how much money was
being made. Absolutely. You can go back to Lou Ranieri days at Salomon Brothers, you know. I mean, it's a lot easier to counter your person and keep him there, and it's a lot easier for the person to stay back, you know, because, and not move for money, because of all the years spent at the firm, having friends, having, you know, political capital built. To hit the restart button is just, you know, very tough. And it's not about, you know, for some of these people, it's not all about, you know, money and, you know, to move. There have to be fundamental reasons to move. And, you know, I mean, if you look at what has happened in the industry, right, I mean, it's a lot easier to stay at your own firm than to get up and go elsewhere. But you do get enticed by money. You know, this is, Wall Street is about money. You do get enticed by money. So, you know, so that's why people take counter offers. And, you know, to be frank with you, I don't blame them, you know.
And it's interesting. The person I was thinking about exactly when I was making that comment was Lou Ranieri. And I spent a few hours, 3 or 4 hours with him a couple months back on interviewing him, too. And I think you made a good point, and you know, it's something that maybe we should comment. You could comment on just a little bit for the record on, besides compensation, what other things did entice these talented people to stay at these major Wall Street firms?
So the what I have learned and what I have seen is, once you get in your 40s, you know, in this business, you know, most people build a pretty sustainable net worth where they can live pretty comfortably. So it's not all about the money for them. It's about the mandate. It's about a challenge. It's about, you know, not being able to grow in your firm to the next level job. It's like, you know, having, you were 40 and having a boss who's 42 where, you know, he's not going anywhere and, you know, you want to get his job. You know, you have to have, you know, sort of a bad taste where you have not been compensated well over the years, or people go and bring people from outside and put them on top of you, and, you know, you've been blocked in sort of, you know, your growth in your career. You know, it has to be where you don't like someone in the group, you know, personality conflicts, where you don't like your boss. you know, where you're not being appreciated. So that these are some of the factors that really sort of makes a person get up and move. And most of the time, from my experience, when I've been able to, you know, the 15% of the time I'm successful in moving to senior people is for a bigger job, is for a bigger mandate. So for example, if you're a CMO trader on a mortgage desk and I get that person the job to be global head of securitized products at a competitive bank that's growing, where, you know, he has to build a division and he wants a challenge, most likely that person would go if the money was right.
So it's not for the most money, it's more for fair, right? They want to be paid fairly for their skill and their talent, but it's not about, you know, it's not only looking for what they're going to get at the end of the year. The values are far greater than just money. And some people actually, you know, don't even really negotiate for that as long as it's fair.
Exactly.
And I think another thing that you might want to comment on, too, Mike, is the other softer issues, meaning who you're working with, who you're sitting next to, who reports to you, who you report to, and the atmosphere, the personality mesh between you and the rest of the people in the firm.
Absolutely. It's very important to be able to, you know, some of these people see their colleagues more than they see their wives and their kids, you know, because they will get to work at, I mean, I met a securitized products guy the other day. He wakes up at 4:30 a.m. in the morning, and he, you know, and he was having a drink with me at 9 o'clock at night, you know. So these guys are, you know, constantly working, and to be in an environment where, you know, it's healthy energy is very, very important, where they like their people, where they, you know, they can get along with them, you know, where there's no negative energy. So it's very important to find that mesh and find that, you know, build that team, because, you know, I mean, Tom, you've been in the business. You know how it is hard to sit next to a, you know, person where you think you're doing all the work and that person is not doing anything, you know. So from technology level guys all the way up to the senior most head of the desk, you know, it has to sort of gel and meld really well.
Right.
You know, some are more intense than the others, and there are, you know, various different personalities in the world, and, you know, those intense guys will work for way more intense guys, and some guys want to work with guys that are, you know, are level-headed, and, you know, there are plenty of level-headed guys, and they want to work with, you know, level-headed guys. You know, as going into university, there's a different school of thought. There's a Harvard and there's a Yale. So, you know, it sort of, you know, really varies firm to firm on the energy and the culture. And the culture is very important for these firms as well, you know?
All right. And one final thing for me, and I want to give it over to the rest of the group, is that just to let this my colleagues know, how long does a placement executive recruiter take on the average, especially for the major deal makers?
That's a pretty tough question. It can take, I mean, I don't want to answer it vaguely, so I'll tell you it takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months.
Or longer?
Or longer. Sometimes, you know, that 3 to 6 months when you have a proper search, that means, you know, a bank comes to you and says, I am looking for a head of pass-throughs. You know, then you go to the pass-through markets and you sort of, you know, interview every pass-through trader. You get them in for an interview. You know one, two, three, who's going to go, who's not going to go. The first one gets countered, you move on to the second one. The second one can get countered, the chances of the third one will go. But, you know, some of the bigger guys can take up to 2 years. So you have to keep courting them. It's like, you know, being an agent.
That's exactly right. So with that, and I'm not going to say anything else because I've taken up too much of your time on sharing some of my insights, but I want to hand it over to Joby and Jane.
Hey, Jennifer, do you want to ask some questions?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to when you had said something about... I think Joby was asking you if people were incentivized by just making deals and not necessarily by the quality. And you said something about they want to win, like they want to win the World Series. I mean, what is it that they're winning? Are they winning market share? What incentivizes them?
they're winning market share. You know, that's what they're winning. So if the market share is $10 billion, and you know you are J.P. Morgan and your desk is making $2 billion, you are number one in that business. You know, you are number one in the league tables across the board. And it's important to go win business outside. When you go into a corporate, the corporate doesn't want to do business with a 19th ranked player. They want to do number. You know, you are Nestle. You don't want to do a deal with a 19th bank. You want to do a deal with a top three bank.
Okay. But I think also you have to kind of consider, you know, other areas, right? Like if you're an equity research analyst, right, your job is to publish research notes and make things that are impactful and, you know, things that can help your clients make the right trade.
Exactly.
That in turn feed sales, you know, sales and trading, right? And you need a platform. So when you're saying when you want to win, you know, you're doing the best you can in your job, which is to help the firm, you know, make better calls and serve your institutions.
And your customers and your clients and your shareholders.
Right. So, you know, I think it's kind of strange to say, like, they had a goal that was disparate from what was in the best interest of the firm or what was the best interest of the clients.
And
they were all in line.
And let me emphasize here that, you know, the top 50 guys at a bank are shareholders as well. So, you know, some of these guys care about the institutions more than an outside institutional investor would, because this is their, you know, life. You know, people have put 20, 25 years in their life. So when you look at what happened in the crisis, and when I meet people from Bear and Lehman and Merrill, you know, some senior people, you know, till today, they're impacted highly by it. Some people put in, you know, 25 years of their careers with, you know, millions of dollars of stock holdings that went to zero.
I mean, I was at Lehman Brothers, you know, for 3 years during 2003. Half the bonus was given in equity with 3 year deferred. So you actually didn't make money. So you had to hold on to a stock for 3 years, which means essentially your bonus was tied to the firm's overall performance.
Okay.
So I think those have always been in line.
Okay.
Do either of you have any thoughts as to how compensation changed when iBanks switched from being partnerships to public companies?
When you were a partnership, people were getting more in cash.
So
if you look at some of the hedge funds, you know, that are partnerships, some of those partners make way more money in cash. So in a way, it was, I mean, it's always great to be a part of a public company and to sort of, you know, see your stock price go up high, right? But the kind of restrictions that some of these banks have, especially, you know, now on selling of the stock are just, you know, it's like climbing a mountain, you know? You guys, you can just, you know, even if you get fired or if you quit your job, you just can't go and sell that stock.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tough to get liquidity. And that's been the case for the last 10 years, I would say.
So that change, that applied to both the senior executives, the CEOs, versus, you know, the traders?
Across the board.
Across the board, okay.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you're starting to see clawback since 2008, and you said that it seems like the industry learned its lesson, and that's why they have reinstituted clawbacks. Is that right?
I've never seen a clawback until 2008.
Okay.
I think because of the tough financial regulations, and, I mean, we are still in a very, very tough regulatory environment, so, you know, people are way more careful. And it's very hard to get guarantees, and it's always been very hard to get guarantees. So this conception of, you know, you go out and you work for a bank and you get a big guarantee is not true. Because even, you know, even 10 years ago, it was very tough for us to get guarantees. You know, like Jessica said earlier, people pay fairly, but to, you know, to basically go and get, you know, massive guarantees, it's still, you know, procedures. We have, you know, clients that will take 2 weeks before they approve an offer.
Okay.
So prior to 2008, you didn't see any clawbacks at all in any of the banks that you observed?
In big contracts, mm-hmm. you know, there were clawbacks. Mm-hmm. But if there were any sign-ons, where if the person sort of got a sign-on bonus and sort of would leave, it never give the money back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I did not see, you know, clawbacks for even, you know, director-level people the way they are today.
Mm-hmm. Is it just the phrase clawbacks? Because people have always received part of their bonus as equity, which is,
yes.
has been deferred,
mm-hmm.
and like restricted stock that's been locked up, right?
And so if you leave, you lose the stock.
Mm-hmm. You leave, or if the firm's stock value plummets, the value of your stock that's still in the queue, that's still restricted, that you can't cash out of, you know, is still yours, right?
And one point I want to make, Tom, coming back to your earlier point where you said that, you know, we see a lot more counteroffers in financial services and other industries. What I have seen is, I don't know other industries that well, but in the technology world, I've seen a lot of counteroffers across the board. So I've seen companies like Google and Yahoo, etc., sort of, you know, counter some of their senior engineers and stuff because they just can't afford to lose them.
Oh, right. Just on the clawbacks for one second there, Mike, is that just wanted to comment on fraud. Would you agree with this statement that officially there is a clawback for over the years on fraud, meaning you do give up your bonuses and other compensation and might have to give back some stuff if any fraud is attached to your activities? Isn't that correct?
100%.
You mentioned that all the companies have instituted these clawbacks since 2008 because of the heavy regulatory environment. Are there any other reasons? Are they also doing it because they think it's good for the company?
Yes.
Do you think there's a relationship or correlation between compensation and risk-taking?
No, I don't think that's the case.
Well, why don't you think that's the case?
Because, you know, you get fired, you lose money, there are, you know, stop losses. You know, there are firms that you're down $25 million, they'll shake your hand and say, go home, bye. People don't want to lose their jobs.
But if you got your bonus for the year, isn't turnover in Wall Street, I know you said 7 years, but isn't turnover in Wall Street these days relatively frequent?
At junior levels, at associate and research associates and analyst levels, but not VP and above.
So,
people want to develop careers, and they want to be at one seat for a long time.
So those junior traders, when they underwrite CDOs and RMBSs, I mean, it's possible that they were incented to generate as much volume as possible without regard to quality and, you know, just aim for their bonus for the year, end of the year.
The whole during that time, the whole market was, you know, underwriting CDOs. You know, the whole world was underwriting CDOs. They thought it was going to go out of style. So it wasn't that a junior trader was trying to, like, you know, increase his volume so that he could get paid $1 million, you know. He was trading. There was so much volume across the board. He was, you know, that person was just there trading. And, you know, from 2005, if you look at how the pricing was going up and up, you know, everyone got hit with the crisis at the same time. So it's hard to comment, you know, whether that person, I mean, I don't think a junior person knew in 2005 that there was going to be a blow up in 2008.
I mean, I guess you're essentially saying something like, you know, if you're trading a biotech stock, you know, that is in phase two, the junior trader trading that biotech stock, right, isn't making the determination on whether or not that drug will get approved and be on the market.
Yeah.
Right? So that's not really his call, and just the fact that he's, you know, engaging in trading biotechnology stocks because that's his job, it doesn't imply that he's willfully engaging in risky activities. Right? People know biotech stocks are very volatile. People know that biotech stocks are very risky. So that's not an obligation that he's taking within his role as far as trading that stock. So I think you might want to look at it more in those terms, you know, with CDO, rather than looking at, you know, that behavior as being an anomaly or perhaps being deliberate.
Mike, you know, I have a question about as the market was changing for RMBS and CDOs, the analysts such as myself saw that there was problems starting in 2006, especially, and then in 2007. Did you see some of these people jumping ship to go to other disciplines, other deal makers, you know, equities or whatever?
I have seen guys from mortgages going into rates and agencies, but I have not seen many of them going into the equity world.
And that's a good point.
They go in fixed income and other divisions, but I don't see them going into, you know, I've seen them go into emerging markets, I've seen them going into rates, agencies, you know, commodities, but I've not seen them go into equities.
But you did, during this period, did you see an increase in people considering leaving in 2007 and 8?
In 08, we saw a lot of people that left because they were really burnt out, you know, after all that happened. 07, we did not see as many people leave the industry. 07, you know, people were still sitting there in the second and third quarter after the big blow-up. They were still, you know, trying to, you know, weather the storm. But in 08, we saw a lot of them get burnt out and leave the business. And look, and that's the trend now as well. You know, with the one point I want to point out, with the regulatory environment the way they are, with the, you know, with risk controls the way they are, you know, where, you know, people are not, you know, cannot take massive risk, with Volcker rule and Frank-Dodd rule and Basel III rulings across the board, right? The general sense in the industry, and I was just in London and Zurich, and it's the same thing, you know, in those countries as well. The whole globe is quite sort of, you know, scrutinized at this point. And people don't want to work harder and make less money, so they're leaving the industry. And I think we're going to see that a lot more in 2011.
But are they leaving the industry completely, or are they jumping ship to different firms?
Completely. I've seen some guys go be teachers. I've seen some guys go in the family businesses. I've seen guys go work for their dad, you know, so it's all over the world, I mean, across the board. And my speculation, and I'm pointing that out actually, you know, in this year's report, that we're going to see a lot more of that phenomena than we've seen before.
Yeah, I've also seen some million-dollar guys open up furniture stores or antique shops.
So you attribute that to the regulatory changes to compensation, all these people leaving.
It comes down to, you know, with all the regulatory, you know, issues that have happened, you're not going to generate, you know, banks are not going to make as much money. You know, derivatives are going to be dead. They're going to be on exchanges. Okay, you know, so what are those guys going to do? They're not just going to sit there and be pure cash traders. They would rather go do something else because, you know, some of them have been compensated well, and it's not all about the money for them. They can live their lives, you know.
I want to go back in time to the ramp up to the financial crisis. You mentioned that from 05 to 07, CDOs and RMBSs were really hot and popping. Did you observe any sort of relaxation of the underwriting standards and the securitization of these products?
Again, I do not know what, you know, how the rules, because I'm a journalist, I'm not a pure securities products expert, mm-hmm. So I didn't know what the rules were, but all I've heard from the people that I work with, that the rules have gotten much stricter and much tighter since 08.
You know what might help us for my associates and even myself to understand? If you're trying to entice a major, upper management, upper person in structured finance to leave, what are the types of questions would you ask that person, about their compensation and other things? Just could you just spend a few minutes, Mike, on going run down your list of questions that you might ask them?
In terms of when I'm interviewing a candidate?
Yes. Yeah, for a higher level position, you know, higher level positions for the real deal makers.
So for the high level position, look, I mean, there are, as you know, Tom, there are only 10 or 12 guys in the world that can do their one specific job, right? So you already know who those people are, and you already have relationships with them over the last 18 years that I've been in the business. You know, I've grown up with some of these guys, you know. They're my age group. They're 42, 45, so I know them really well. So the first thing is to know that whether they're happy in their seat that they're on, and if they're not happy in their seat, then you have to approach them and you have to convince them to talk to the, you know, the party that might be interested. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you ask them, you know, again, same, you know, from education, where they went to university, you know, what their career is, how, you know, how many years they've been in the business, you know, what kind of desks they've run, how many headcounts they've managed, you know, what kind of budgets and P&Ls they've managed, you know, how they've grown their business over the years, you know, what the outlook for them is for that firm, what they think of the competitive firms, who do they know there, how well do they know them, because this industry, as you know, Tom, is very small, so everyone knows each other, you know, and as a headhunter, the only way you can get in the middle of the deal is, you know, if a foreign bank is coming in to, you know, grow this business, you know, and they don't know anyone here, or the guy specifically calls you and tells you, go rep me over here, because I need someone in the middle to talk compensation with this guy, because I don't want to talk compensation directly with him, you know what I'm saying, right? I want to go through a third party. So, you know, those are the kind of questions that sort of pop up for very senior level positions.
Unrelated question. I was just wondering whether you had any thoughts as to whether the iBanks that survived, such as Goldman Sachs and Morgan, had different compensation schemes than, you know, the Bear Stearns and Lehman and the Merrills.
Yeah, they survived because, you know, they're strictly controlled, and so was Lehman, and so was, look, Lehman, Baird, Goldman, Morgan have pretty similar compensation schemes, right? You know, Goldman, Morgan had better balance sheets, and I would say better management across the board at the senior level to have kept the firms together. I would say Lehman and Baird did not have really strong senior management teams.
How about risk management?
Or risk management.
Okay. But do you think compensation...
And risk management, I would say.
Okay. But were there any differences in their compensation schemes, or?
I mean, not really. They were pretty similar, all of them. You know, all of them paid a base and a bonus, and, you know, the bonus, the equity came in a form of cash and stock for senior people was as high as 60%, you know, over the years.
Did Goldman have a longer deferral, for example, in terms of cashing out the options?
Yes, yes. For senior management, I think they have a much stricter deferral.
And do you think that helped their viability?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It definitely helped their survivability. And I think, you know, after reading all the books and all that stuff that, you know, I've read, and, you know, my view on this thing is that, you know, those firms were pretty well sort of risk controlled, and, you know, and turning Goldman and Morgan into a bank holding company helped a lot as well.
Mike, also on the compensation side, if you are successful to convince a candidate to take an offer with one of the competitors, and they would be losing X amount of dollars with their stocks and so on, can you give us a little more color on what the bank would entice them to make that move, including making them whole?
I got your point. I'll explain it to you, right? So if you get paid stock, and over the years you've accumulated $3 million worth of unvested stock, and your stock is going to vest over, you know, on the third year it's going to start vesting. So 30% you will get on the fourth year, 30% you will get on the fifth year, 33% you will get on the sixth year. Well, you know what some of these competitors like to do is, if you are within the vesting schedule, they entice you with buying it in cash. So they put a cash value on your start date of that stock, and they will take that 30%. So at $3 million, they'll probably give you $1 million in cash to, you know, so they can cash you out, and the other two you have to keep until the other two will swap in their own stock, which will have its own vesting schedule. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay, so that's how they entice them. So they entice them by either cashing them out on the vested piece, you know, and buying it out, you know, or swapping it outright, you know, or maybe swapping it and giving them, you know, 500 grand or $1 million more on top, you know, with a much tighter vesting schedule, you know, to come in.
Jennifer, do you have questions?
Not at this moment.
Okay, perfect. So, you know, glad to talk to you. Tom, if you need anything, you know, please let me know.
I sure will. And I guess, Joby, do you have
any? Yeah, one very last question. As you know, we're tasked to investigate the causes of financial collapse. Do you have any comments or observations since you've been in Wall Street for a while?
I mean, look, I'm of the school of thought that letting Lehman go was, you know, a big failure, and I think, you know, Lehman and or Bear should have been given a fair shot of sort of, you know, being made into bank holding companies, mm-hmm. and, you know, they should have been given a chance, just like LTCM was in 98, to sort of unwind properly. I think the world would have been a different place today.
Was it your expectation coming into that Lehman weekend that the government would pull through?
Yes, 100%.
So you were surprised that Sunday, or I guess Monday, September 15th, when Lehman filed for bankruptcy?
I was surprised in March when I was at a movie and I got 70 emails from my colleagues and from different Bear Stearns people when Bear was merged with J.P. Morgan.
Okay. Was it your expectation?
My surprise came in March, not in September when Lehman was let go.
Was it your expectation that since the Fed helped Bear Stearns that they would end up helping Lehman?
Yes, absolutely. And let me just tell you something. I was in the middle of, you know, both Bear and Lehman of, you know, talking to individuals at senior levels and trying to get them to competitors, and none of them left the ship, and they did not abandon the ship. They stayed there, and they stayed till the end.
Is this a belief that, it's a technical term, that Lehman was too big to fail? Do you believe that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they let it fail, so it was big to fail, you know what I'm saying, right?
Okay. And you said that the cause of the failure of Lehman was somewhat the cause. Can you elaborate, give more color as to why Lehman was important?
I mean, look, I did not work for Lehman, and, you know, I'm not trying to be a proponent for Lehman here, but, you know, what I hear, I speak to a lot of people in the industry, mm-hmm. and, you know, as a headhunter, Tom knows this better than anyone else, that, you know, all we do is get information, we don't make information, mm-hmm. so, you know, I mean, the information that I get and the data that I collect, you know, every single individual that's on Wall Street at senior level says that to me, that, you know, they should have not, that Lehman should not have failed, Lehman should not have failed.
Mm-hmm. And any other thoughts on the changes in compensation? What are you seeing in Wall Street besides the increasing number of clawbacks? Any other changes?
The only other change we've seen is the base salaries have been increased, and mm-hmm. you know, the reason for that is because, you know, the firms are trying to sort of make sure that the bonus pools are not out of whack, and, you know, they are in line. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's the only one big change that we've seen. Jessica, anything else you've seen?
No, I mean, I think that's probably most significant is the fact that now, because so much of the bonus is put into equity, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the junior people are now cash constrained, right? Because they depend on their bonus to mm-hmm. take care of real matters. And so, you know, firms have had to make this increase in the base salary, you know, simply so that people can live, mm-hmm. right? So they can make they can have compensation that can sustain their life.
The one other point I want to add is, you know, New York is not the Midwest. So if you're a 26-year-old guy, you know, making $100,000, and you know, in the Midwest, it might look like $100,000 is a huge amount of money, but you can't live in New York on $100,000.
And what's your forecast for this coming year, I suppose, to 2007 in terms of the bonus pool
down.
In Wall Street?
Down.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you very much, Mike and Jessica, and we're officially going off record right now, and on behalf of the Commission, I'd like to thank you and also remind you just to keep this confidential among us, and If you need us for anything too, please reach out to us also. And Mike, I would just like to ask if the staff could reach out to you with any specific question, or to Jessica, if you don't mind.
Please, absolutely. And Tom, will you send us the findings of this?
Oh yeah, well the book is gone. I'll sign you a copy of the book if you'd like. After I leave the commission, it has to be on the bookshelves on December 15th when we give it to the president and to Congress.
And you can pre-order from Amazon.com. It's already up.
Oh okay. If you can give me a signed copy, I would love it.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Bye.